I'm Paul Harris, proud to have you along every afternoon from 2 until 6 here on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Thank you for listening, and thank you for also visiting my website, harrisonline.com, where I have my blog and my columns and audio from this show, guests you may have missed, and the ever-popular picture of the day. Several times over the last month or so, I have put up some of the Quirkology videos from Professor Richard Wiseman, who is the professor of the public understanding of psychology at the University of Hertfordshire in England, and a guy I met a couple of years ago at one of James Randi's amazing meetings in Las Vegas. I've seen him give terrific presentations there, and we've gotten to know each other a little bit. And I had Richard on the show back in May, and at the time he said, well, my book is coming out in the fall. And I said, well, we'll have to have you come on the show again. And so now he's here in the States, and the book has just been released. It is, the full American title is Quirkology: How We Discover the Big Truths in Small Things. Richard, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you for having me.
Congratulations not only on the book, but also the success of these videos, which I believe have been viewed now by a couple million people. Is that right?
That's correct. And it is amazing that there's an audience out there for these rather sort of weird and quirky mixture of psychology and magic tricks. And it's wonderful. You know, we sit and think of these rather bizarre ideas, make them up, stick them online, and suddenly thousands of people are watching them and commenting on them. So, no, it's wonderful.
Now, I do have to say, knowing you a little bit and the kind of work you do, there is part of me that thinks that you're putting these videos up as part of one of your experiments to gauge reaction.
We are thinking of actually working on one at the moment, which is really quite explicitly an experiment. So we'll be asking people in the comment section to write something which will then become data. But the ones that are there at the moment really are, honestly, hold up my hands, absolutely just for fun. They're for people to enjoy, to think about. Sometimes there's some problem solving. Sometimes it's based on some ideas in magic, other times in psychology. But at the moment they're there, you know, for people to enjoy, and it is great that so many people do that.
And there's one you have up now called Quirkology, in which you use the power of your mind, I'm putting that in quotes, to float a cork in the air, and you say you're going to reveal how you do that in a couple of days, right?
That's right. Quirkology is our latest one, and in some ways my favorite, actually. The idea came to me a few months ago, and I just thought there's a really interesting way of doing a new sort of levitation, and magicians love levitating objects and have done for many years, but I sort of came up with a twist on some of their ideas, and we thought we'd make this one into a competition so people can see it on YouTube, but also if they go to the Quirkology website, they can actually enter a competition. They give us their explanation, and then the winner gets a copy of the book. So it makes it a little bit more interactive and fun for people.
Now, it's interesting because you're not just a psychologist, but also have been a professional magician, and you use deception in both of those fields, and you've actually studied deception, haven't you?
Absolutely. My PhD was on the types of deception that pseudo-psychics, fake psychics use to convince you they have amazing abilities. So if you go along for a psychic reading and they give you one of those kind of general statements that we all like to believe about ourselves, such as, I can see you have a lot of untapped creative potential. You know, we all love to go, oh, yes, yes, how insightful of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And another favorite of mine is, the way your hand is, if it's palmistry, you have an above-average sense of humor. People enjoy being around you. And when we've done research, 95% of people claim to have an above-average sense of humor.
and mathematically, by definition, that can't be.
That is not the case. You know, there has to be some people out there that are not funny and don't get the gags. But they just don't seem to realize that they fall into that category. So these statements are psychologically fascinating. I don't think there's anything psychic going on. But part of my PhD was looking at the way in which psychics convince strangers they know all about them. So I started looking at deception very early on, then moved on to the psychology of lying, the sorts of signals that we give out when we're a little bit economical with the truth. And that's what really got me into quirky research, because the very first study that I did in lying was a mass participation one with the BBC. We put up two clips of a well-known political interviewer at that point called Sir Robin Day. In one, he was lying, in the other, telling the truth. And we asked people to phone in and try and spot the lie. And we had 30,000 people do it. So it was one of the very first mass participation experiments about 10 years ago.
And you noticed two interesting things. One, that if you use the word I, you're probably not lying.
That's right.
And also, that people who listen to us on the radio are much more perceptive than those who will watch you tomorrow on Good Morning America.
And thank you for the plug.
You're welcome.
That's right. So basically, we are overwhelmed with visual information. We are visual creatures, large parts of the brain put aside for visual processing. And so when we see someone's body language or facial expressions, we really do focus on them. We would look to see whether they rub their hands together or they maintain eye contact. Now, lots of studies have shown that those sorts of signals really are not correlated with lying or truth-telling. So good liars will look you straight in the eye. People who are telling the truth maybe appear nervous and move around. These are not reliable signals. However, the words that people say and how they say them, where they're hesitant, where they talk about themselves, whether they include lots of detail, all of these sorts of things actually are pretty reliable signals. And if you focus people's attention on those, and one way of doing it is to get them to listen to the radio, for example, then they become much better lie detectors. And so one of the things we found out is that if you were a dishonest politician, keep off of the radio. It's the worst possible place for you. Get yourself onto television because people can't tell whether you're lying or not.
Now, you know why I find that so fascinating is because there's a story, maybe urban legend or it may be fact, about the 1960 U.S. presidential election, which was the first time we really had televised debates. And that those debates were between then Vice President Richard Nixon and Senator John Kennedy, who, of course, we all know was elected President of the United States. And in the debates, Nixon had a heavy beard and sweated a lot and looked terrible in his makeup. And Kennedy, who was a handsome man, came across great on television. And the majority of people who watched those debates thought that Kennedy won easily. But the people who listened to it on the radio and couldn't see any of those things thought Nixon won the debates. And, of course, we know the history of Richard Nixon.
Indeed. And I think the story is true, actually. My understanding is that that's absolutely the case. And that relates to some of the other work that's in the book, which is when you look at the people who made it to the Senate and you compare the faces of the winners to the losers for each of those positions, and you just have people rate them, people who don't know which one and which person lost, you just rate them on whether or not it looks like a competent politician, you actually find they can predict who won the race for the Senate because it's the people who appear to be competent, just look competent. And again, this is one of the kind of quick shortcuts that we use. When we're overwhelmed with information, perhaps with political parties, when we're trying to think about their education or health policy or whatever, it gets very complicated, we just make a shortcut. And we go, well, I don't know, who looks like the most competent person here? And that's who we end up voting for.
And therefore, is there a way for you to come up with a quirkological prediction for who will become president next year?
There would be if we looked at the candidates very closely. One of the things we've done, actually, on political candidates, which is in the American edition of the book, is to make a sort of merge of the last six Democratic presidents and the last six Republican ones to get the kind of generic Republican and Democratic image. And it's absolutely amazing. They look very different. When we ask Brits, British people, to rate these sort of morphed average faces, the average Republican was seen as far more authoritarian and less kind of giving than the average Democrat. So it may be that people are winning the race for the White House in that instance because they have the right kind of face. And those images are in the book.
And what I find interesting, having seen those images, is when you actually morph them together, who do they look like?
Well, to my untrained eye, they looked like Bush for the Republican, and the Democrat looked a lot like Clinton.
Yeah.
Even when we removed those two images, so we took Bush and Clinton out of the morph, you still get those kind of features coming through. So it's kind of fascinating just how much psychology there is to be unpacked in these situations if you look in the right way.
When you were on with me in May, Richard, you were about to embark on a project called Total Recall, something to do with thousands of images in Piccadilly Circus. Did you eventually go on with that experiment?
Absolutely. That was following up on some research that had first been conducted in the early 1970s, looking at the upper range, just upper limit of visual memory, basically how many images could someone remember. And so what we did there was to bombard two volunteers, and we have some video of them on the website being bombarded with images. Not 1,000 images, not 5,000 images, but actually 10,000 images over the course of 3 days. They saw each image for just a few seconds. They just sat there and looked at these things being projected up in front of them. And then the question was, how many could they recognize? So we gave them a test at the end of the day, and our results were in keeping with the results of the 1970s. We were the sort of first people to replicate it. But actually, they could remember around about 75% of the images, so about 7,500 images, even though they'd only seen them for a few seconds. And what it shows is what amazing, again, visual animals we are, that we are incredibly good at taking this information without realizing it, and we have this incredible ability to store huge amounts of images in our brain. So it's a very unusual experiment, very ambitious, and great that we got two people to do it. And it was actually two kind of psychology colleagues of mine who put themselves through it. They sort of lost the will to live after day two, but they kept on going. We kept supplying them with cookies and coffee, and that was enough.
Images, incidentally, were not, you know, it wasn't like a grape, a building, a cloud. It was not that distinct. There were some that were, here's an elk facing to the right, here's an elk facing to the left, right?
Yes, we were very keen on elks, actually. there were
I noticed that.
Yes. But, I mean, that was very bizarre, because to get 10,000 images, we just went to one of these kind of image library and things. They'd give us a random selection. And we ended up with about 20 elks. We were elks out. So we had elks looking to the right, looking to the up, looking down, looking slightly quirky, looking rather quizzical. And so, you know, the two participants kept saying, what's this thing with elks? You know, what's going on? And I said, it's just random is what they gave us. So you're absolutely right. Yeah, they were sometimes different to one another, but sometimes it really quite fine-grained the differences.
Now, it's interesting because you've done so much experimenting on how visual images, well, that's redundant, but you know what I mean, how the visual impacts our decision-making. You write in the book that if you are a better-looking defendant in a criminal case, you have a much better chance of being found not guilty.
Yes.
Explain that.
That was based on some research that we did, again, a few years ago with the BBC, and there we had two actors playing the parts of defendants. One a kind of good-looking, blue-eyed, baby-faced guy. The other looking like a stereotypical criminal. So sort of deep-set eyes and broken nose and sort of bigger-built guy. And we showed everyone on television exactly the same evidence from a criminal trial. But the BBC has 13 transmitters across the UK, and what we persuaded the BBC to do was to transmit one defendant to half of the country and the other defendant to the other half, which is technically very difficult, but they took the challenge on and did it. And then we asked everyone to vote on whether or not that they thought the person was guilty. So they'd all seen exactly the same evidence, but one seen the good-looking guy and one seen the guy that looked like a stereotypical criminal. And there's around about a 20% difference in terms of their votes. So far more people convicted the guy who just happened to look like the sorts of stereotypes we carry around in our heads, even though they've been presented with exactly the same evidence. So it was a kind of very striking experiment. Also, for me, it was very memorable because I had to explain live on television to the actor who looked like sort of the ideas of what we carry around in our head, that he did look like a sort of criminal.
He was a punk. He was a thug. He was a dirtball.
Exactly. That's what I had to say to him. And what I found out just slightly before the broadcast is he had got a record for assault.
Huh.
So there's me, sort of opposite him, trying to explain to everyone why he's been convicted, thinking, you know, I hope he doesn't get too upset about this because he's got a bit of a record there. And then it does bring it home. You think, you know, maybe, we know from lots of other research, that our faces can become really the basis for self-fulfilling prophecies.
Now, does that mean that if you do end up becoming the defendant in a criminal matter, a haircut, a shave, and some blue contacts would be a good idea?
Yes, or get someone else to stand in for you. That's always my advice.
Get Brad Pitt on the phone.
Exactly.
I'm in trouble here.
A Brad Pitt lookalike. Those people could make real money being stand-in defendants.
Talking today with Dr. Richard Wiseman, whose book is called Quirkology, How We Discover the Big Truths in Small Things. If you haven't seen his YouTube videos, you will find links to them. In fact, they're embedded right there on the Picture of the Day page on my website, harrisonline.com, or you can just go to YouTube and type in Quirkology, and you will find them. Richard, why do people believe such weird things? I mean, ghosts and superstition and astrology and all of these things. You've studied some of them, haven't you?
studied most of them, actually. That's my main area of academic research, is the psychology of belief in the paranormal. And I think people believe them for very many different things. I mean, if unfortunately you've lost a loved one, then the idea of still being in touch with them and going on to a medium and having a conversation with them, clearly very appealing. For people who are worried about their future, the idea that somehow it's all mapped out in the stars and everything's going to be fine, again, is a very appealing idea. The problem is that the evidence really doesn't support these claims. And so one of the studies I describe in the book is the astrology study, where we decided to look at financial astrology. And here you have astrologers who will look at the birth date of a company, the day it was put together and sort of registered, and from that map out when is a good time and a bad time to invest in that company.
Wait a minute. There are actually people who claim to be financial astrologers?
Absolutely. There are people who make very good livings from saying to investors, now is a good time to invest in this particular stock because the stars are in the right positions. And people put their money up for this sort of thing.
Seems ripe for debunking.
Absolutely. That's what I thought. So we did this experiment as part of Science Week in the UK, where we had one of these financial astrologers, we had a professional investor, and then we had a five-year-old child with not very much investment experience at all, in fact, none. And we gave them all a notional £5,000. We said you can choose any stocks and shares on the FTSE 100, which is the top 100 companies in the UK. And we're going to map and monitor and see how well you do over the week. So the astrologer looked to the stars and made her choices. The investor ran away to his computer and made his. And with the kid, we just wrote down the name of each company on a piece of paper, threw them all up in the air, and she just grabbed five of them as they kind of fluttered to the ground. And that was her random choices.
Oh, I hope what I hope is coming is actually coming.
It is exactly what you think. So at the end of the week, we all sat down and had a look, and the astrologer had come last. Quite a big drop in her portfolio. The investor was second, and the child had won. So immediately it was really interesting, because the astrologer, who could have just said, oh, well, you know, it's been a bad week or whatever, said, oh, you know, I knew I shouldn't have taken part because I found out that the kid was a Piscean and they're notoriously lucky and you should never go against Pisceans in these things.
So, they always have an excuse, don't they?
They've always got an excuse. And also they said, well, a week is a very short term in terms of investments. So we decided to extend their predictions over a year. And at the end of the year, we all got together again. And this time, out of the three, the kid was the only one to make a small profit. They made about a 6% profit. The astrologer and the investor each lost between about 30 and 40% of their amount. So not exactly overwhelming evidence for psychic ability.
I love that. I love that. But you're continuing to look into these bizarre paranormal things. And I think actually you're continuing a branch of the work that our friend James Randi does, which is taking a look at these things and saying, let's put some rationality into this instead of just going with the wild guesses based on somebody making paranormal claims, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we go out and test psychics. Probably the most the one which is most dramatic and, again, described in the book is the one I actually get asked when I give talks, that the video clip that most people want to see is the firewalking demonstration, which was, again, conducted on television, because if I'd have done it as a psychologist, it would have been intensely unethical. And one of the great things about working on television is you can do all those experiments that you really want to do as a scientist. And so there we had some firewalkers who were professionals. They were teaching other people how to do this thing of walking along hot beds of coals. And of course, the science is that not very much heat is conducted from the bed to your feet, providing you walk fairly quickly, and there's a good motivation to do that. And also, in order that not so much heat is conducted, that the bed of coal should be around about 12 or 15 feet long. Now, these people, the firewalkers we were interested in, were saying, no, this isn't science, this is paranormal. We put a kind of energetic force field around our body, and that's the reason we can do this stuff.
Right.
Exactly. So we thought, a bit like the astrology, let's put it to the test. So we didn't build one bed of coals that was 15 feet. We actually built one that was 60 feet long. We said, look, the science here predicts you're going to burn yourself. They said, no, we'll put this energetic force field around our body. We'll be able to get to the end of this enormously long bed of coals. And so they tried it live. And the producers, people making the program, were very, very excited because they said, you know, either these people are going to break the laws of physics, in which case that's great, or they're going to burn themselves badly, and that's good television as well. So either way, it's a doubleheader. And we off they went, knowing the dangers, and 12, 15 feet in, the first one jumped off with second-degree burns. The second person had a go, exactly the same response, so they ended up in hospital. At that point, interesting enough, some of the other paranormal firewalkers weren't quite so keen to go ahead with it. And I went over to one of them, because normally in these things, when you test someone and you come with disconfirming evidence, they don't change their belief. But here, they were clearly changing their behavior, at least. So I went over and I said, yeah, it's really curious because, you know, you decided not to walk. And this woman said, yeah, I decided not to do it. And I said, well, was it because your colleagues got burned? And she said, no, not at all. For me, it's not about an energetic force field. It's about my guardian angel that sits on my shoulder.
Ah.
And it's my guardian angel that protects me. And lo and behold, just before I'm about to start the firewalk, my guardian angel vanishes, so I think I shouldn't do it.
Uh-huh.
So I thought, that's kind of interesting, you know, a guardian angel that's only there for the good times. And as soon as there's any danger.
Yeah, you would think if it was really your guardian angel, maybe that guardian angel would pick you up as you went across the coals and you wouldn't get burned.
Absolutely. But I do find it appealing, the idea of, you know, a guardian angel that's there on your shoulder until something bad happens.
Right.
And then they leave.
That's classic.
Yeah. So that's what we did with the firewalking, and we've done lots of things like that, testing psychic dogs and so on, and none of them really have passed any kind of test on this stuff. I don't think there's any reality to any of these psychic claims.
Right.
But psychologically, I think it's absolutely fascinating.
Now, there are a couple of tests that you have both in the book and on the Quirkology website that we can actually try with my listeners right now.
Okay.
One of them is the finger test. Can you explain that one?
It's a very, very good question, and the answer is not off the top of my head. Which one? This is the finger.
This is the Q.
The Q. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So what they need to do is to trace with their finger, first finger, a Q, a capital Q, on their forehead. So don't do it with a pen because that will mark,
yes.
and you look silly for the rest of the day. But to do it, just naturally draw a capital Q. So if people do that without thinking about it, there's a couple of ways that they can do it. They can either draw it so that they themselves can read it. So, you know, essentially with the tail of the Q over their right eye.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can draw it so somebody facing them can read it, i.e. with the tail over their left eye.
Mm-hmm.
And this tells us a lot about them. So if they're drawing it so they themselves can read it, they tend to be the sorts of people that are kind of, you know, what you see is what you get. They're not going to change how they are in different situations. They have a strong sense of identity. And they tend to be pretty honest, straightforward people. They're not very good at pretending to be someone else. And that's why they're looking at situations from their own perspective. The people who draw the Q, so somebody who's facing them could read it, are the sorts of people who are what psychologists call high self-monitors. They're interested in how they are perceived by others. Often they describe themselves as being a different person in different situations. They're much better at telling the odd fib or two because they're very good at controlling their verbal and nonverbal responses. And so, you know, if you're a salesman or a politician or anybody in the whole influence industry, then they tend to be the high self-monitors. So it's very simple. This test has been well-researched and does split people.
The finger test and also the thumb test, which we don't have time to get into here, which is just about the interlacing of your hands when you put them down in front of you. If you'd like to find out what that means and where your thumb goes and what it says about you based on all this research, you can go to Richard's website, which is Quirkology.com. It's also the name of his book, Quirkology, How We Discover the Big Truths in Small Things. What are you working on now? What's the next Quirkology experiment you're going to embark on?
Well, we have a few things going on. We're in the sort of planning stages. Any of these experiments do require quite a big run-up because you need to get it right if you're going to have tens of thousands of people doing it. We're looking at the psychology of timekeeping. I'm fascinated by why some people are continually late and others are continually early for meetings.
Uh-huh.
I fall into the continually early school, and so the number of times I've sat there waiting for someone else to turn up is both annoying and very large. So
I'm with you.
Right. So I'm interested in why people are late, and is it that they just underestimate how long it gets to take them to get from A to B? Is it that they don't really care that it's your time they're wasting, and so on? So we're looking at that, and also we're going to take a look at the idea of karma. Not so much reincarnation, the idea that, you know, if you've done something bad in the past, then you're punished for it in this life, because that's a tricky one to look at scientifically. But rather this idea that if you do good things to others, do good things come to you. So it's a very ambitious project, and we're working on it right now.
I can't wait to talk to you about them as they go forward. Thanks always for your time, Richard. It's a pleasure.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Richard Wiseman, the book is a great read. It's Quirkology, How We Discover the Big Truths in Small Things. There'll be a link to it in moments on my website, harrisonline.com. This is KMOX.